Part 1. Frenzy. May 5th, 1996. Asalar Oasis, Mali, Africa. Chapter 1. After traveling through the desert for days or weeks, seeing no animals, meeting no humans, civilization, no matter how tiny or primitive, comes as a stunning surprise. To the 11 people in the 5 Land Rovers, plus 5 tour driver guides, the sight of a man-made habitat came as a great relief. Hot and unwashed, tired after a week of driving across pure desolation, the adventurous tourists on the Backworld Explorations 12-day Across the Sahara Safari were only too happy to see humans and find enough water for a refreshing bath. They sighted the village of Asalar sitting in barren isolation in the central Sahara region of the African nation of Mali. A sprawl of mud houses clustered around a well in the dry bottom of what must have been an ancient riverbed. Scattered around the outskirts were the crumbling ruins of 100 or more abandoned houses, and beyond them the low banks that dropped below the alluvial plain. From a distance the village was almost impossible to see, so well did the time-worn buildings merge with the austere and colorless landscape.
"Well, there she is,"
pointed Major Ian Fairweather, the safari leader, to the tired and dusty tourists who exited the Land Rovers and grouped around him.
"You'd never know to look at her that Asalar was once a cultural crossroads of Western Africa. For 5 centuries it was an important watering hole for the great trade and slave caravans that passed through to the north and east."
"Why did it go into decline?" asked a comely Canadian woman in halter top and brief shorts.
"A combination of wars and conquests by the Moors and the French, the abolition of slavery, but mostly because the trade routes moved south and west toward the seacoasts. The death blow came about 40 years ago when its wells began to dry up. The only flowing well that still supports the town has been dug nearly 50 meters deep."
"Not exactly a metropolitan paradise," muttered a stout man in a Spanish accent.
Major Fairweather forced a smile. A tall, lean ex-Royal Marine, who prodigiously puffed on a long filtered cigarette, he spoke in clipped, seemingly rehearsed tones.
"Only a few Tuareg families that gave up the nomadic tradition reside in Asalar now. They mainly subsist on small herds of goats, patches of sandy soil irrigated by hand from the central village well, and a few handfuls of gemstones gleaned from the desert that they polish and carry by camel to the city of Gao, where they sell them as souvenirs."
A London barrister, impeccably dressed in khaki safari suit and pith helmet, pointed an ebony cane at the village.
"Looks abandoned to me. I seem to recall your brochure stating that our tour group would be enthralled by the romance of desert music and native dancing under flickering campfires of Asalar."
"I'm sure our advanced scout has made every arrangement for your comfort and enjoyment," Fairweather assured him with airy confidence.
He gazed for a moment at the sun setting beyond the village.
"It will be dark soon. We'd better move on into the village."
"Is there a hotel there?" asked the Canadian lady. Fairweather stifled a pained look.
"No, Mrs. Lansing. We camp in the ruins just beyond the town."
A collective groan went up from the tourists. They had hoped for a soft bed in private bathrooms, luxuries Asalar had probably never known. The group reboarded the vehicles, then drove down a worn trail into the river valley and onto the main road leading through the village. The closer they came, the more difficult it was to visualize a glorious past. The streets were narrow alleyways and composed of sand. It seemed a dead town that reeked of defeat. No light was seen in the dusk, no dog barked a greeting. They saw no sign of life in any of the mud buildings. It was as though the inhabitants had packed up and vanished into the desert. Fairweather began to feel uneasy. Something was clearly wrong. There was no sign of his advance scout. For an instant he caught a glimpse of a large four-legged animal scurrying into a doorway. But it seemed so fleeting he shrugged it off as a shadow from the moving Land Rovers. His merry band of clients would be grumbling tonight, he thought. Damn those advertising people for over-exaggerating the allure of the desert. An opportunity to experience a once-in-a-lifetime expedition across the nomadic sands of the Sahara, he recited under his breath.
He'd have wagered a year's pay the copywriter had never ventured past the Dover coast. They were almost 80 kilometers from the Trans-Sahara Motor Track, and a good 240 from the Niger River city of Gao. The safari carried more than enough food, water, and fuel for the remainder of the journey, so Fairweather kept open an option to bypass Asalar should an unforeseen problem arise. The safety of Backworld Explorations clients came first, and in 28 years they had yet to lose one, unless they counted the retired American plumber who teased a camel and was kicked in the head for his stupidity. Fairweather began to wonder why he saw no goats or camels. Nor did he see any footprints in the sandy streets, only strange claw marks and round indentations that traveled in parallel as though twin logs were dragged about. The small tribal houses, built of stone and covered with a reddish mud, appeared more run down and decayed since Fairweather had passed through on the last safari not more than 2 months ago. Something was definitely amiss. Even if, for some odd reason, the villagers had deserted the area, his advance scout should have met them. In all the years they had driven the Sahara together, Ibn Hajib had never failed him. Fairweather decided to allow his charges to rest for a short time at the village well and rinse off, before continuing some distance into the desert and making camp. Better keep a guarded eye, he thought, as he pulled his old Royal Marine Patchett submachine gun from a compartment between the seats and tucked it upright between his knees. On the muzzle he threaded an Invicta silencer, giving the weapon the look of an extended pipe with a long curved shell clip protruding from it. "Something wrong?" asked Mrs. Lansing, who along with her husband rode in Fairweather's Land Rover. "Just a precaution to scare away beggars," Fairweather lied. He stopped the four-wheel drive and walked back, warning his drivers to keep a sharp lookout for anything suspicious. Then he returned and drove on, leading the column to the center of the town and passing through the narrow and sandy streets that were laid out in no particular order. At last he stopped under a lonely date palm that stood in the middle of a spacious marketplace near a circular stone well about 4 meters in diameter. Fairweather studied the sandy ground about the well in the last light of the day. It was surrounded by the same unusual tracks he'd spotted in the streets. He stared down into the well. He barely saw a tiny reflection deep in the bowels of the sandstone. He recalled that the water was quite high in mineral content that gave it a metallic taste and tinted it a milky green. Yet it had quenched the thirst of many lives, human and animal, over the centuries. Whether it was hygienic for the uninitiated stomachs of his clients did not concern Fairweather. He merely intended for them to use it to rinse the sweat and dust off their bodies, not drink it. He instructed his drivers to stand guard and then showed the tourists how to hoist a pigskin bucket of water by use of an ancient hand winch tied to a frayed rope. The exotic image of desert music and dancing by flickering campfires was quickly forgotten as they laughed and splashed like children in a lawn sprinkler on a hot summer afternoon. The men stripped to the waist and slapped water on their bare skin. The women were more concerned with washing their hair. The comical scene was eerily illuminated by the Land Rover's headlights that threw their cavorting shadows on the silent walls of the village like film projectors. While Fairweather's drivers watched and laughed, he walked a fair distance down one of the streets and entered a house that stood next to a mosque. The walls appeared old and time-worn. The entrance led through a short arched tunnel to a courtyard that was littered with so much human trash and rubble that he had difficulty climbing over it. He shone a flashlight around the main room of the structure. The walls were a dusty white, the roofs high with exposed poles over a stick matting, much like the Latia Viga on the ceilings of Santa Fe architecture of the American Southwest. The walls were indented with many niches for keeping household goods in, but they were all empty, their contents scattered and broken around the floor along with jumbled furniture. Because nothing obvious appeared to be missing, it looked to Fairweather as if vandals had simply trashed the house after the occupants had fled, leaving all their possessions behind. Then he spotted a pile of bones in one corner of the room. He identified them as human and began to feel extremely uneasy. In the glimmer of the flashlight, shadows formed and played weird tricks on the eyes. He swore he saw a large animal flit past a window to the courtyard. He removed the safety on the patchet, not so much from fear as from a sixth sense of the menace that was forming in the darkening alleyways. A rustling sound came from behind a closed doorway that opened onto a small terrace. Fairweather approached the door quietly, stepping softly around the debris. If there was someone hiding inside, they went silent. Fairweather held the flashlight in front of him with one hand and gripped the submachine gun, muzzle aimed forward, with the other. Then he kicked the door open, knocking it off the hinges onto the floor where it threw up a cloud of dust. There was someone there, all right. Or was it something? Dark-skinned and evil, like a demon escaped from hell. It looked like an animal-like subhuman, swaying on hands and knees, staring insanely into the beam of light through eyes that were as red as burning coals. Fairweather instinctively stepped back. The thing reared up on its knees and lunged at him. Fairweather calmly squeezed the trigger on the patchet, holding the butt of the gun against his flexed stomach muscles. A rapid stream of 9mm, 100-weight grain, round-nose bullets spat from the muzzle with the muffled sound of popcorn popping. The hideous beast made a ghastly retching sound and collapsed, its chest almost blown away. Fairweather stepped up to the huddled form, leaned over, and beamed his flashlight on it. The body was filthy and completely naked. The wild eyes were staring sightlessly, a bright red where white should have been. The face was that of a boy, no more than 15. A fear struck with such shock, such stunning force, that Fairweather was for several moments numbed with the realization of the danger. He knew now what made the odd tracks in the sand. There must have been a whole colony of them that crawled through the village. He turned suddenly and began running back to the marketplace. But he was too late, far too late. A wall of shrieking fiends burst from the evening dark and tore headlong into the unwary tourists at the well. The drivers were swallowed in the seething tidal wave before they could cry out an alarm or put up a shred of defense. The savage horde came on hands and knees like jackals, pulling down the unarmed tourists and snapping at any exposed skin with their teeth. The horrible nightmare, illuminated by the headlights of the Land Rovers, became a frenzied press of writhing bodies with the terrified screams of the panic-stricken tourists mingled with the banshee shrieks of their attackers. Mrs. Lansing gave a tortured cry and disappeared in a tangled mass of bodies. Her husband tried to climb on the hood of one of the vehicles but was pulled down into the dust and mutilated like a beetle under an army of ants. The fastidious Londoner twisted the head of his cane from a hollow sheath, revealing a short sword. He flayed about him viciously, temporarily keeping the mob at bay. But they seemed to possess no fear and quickly overwhelmed him. The area around the well was choked solidly with struggling humanity. The fat Spanish man, blood streaming from several teeth wounds, jumped into the well to escape, but four of the crazed killers jumped in after him. Fairweather ran up and crouched, firing the patchet into the surging attackers, careful not to shoot one of his own people. The mob, unable to hear the silenced gun, ignored the unexpected gunfire, and were either too crazed or too indifferent to realize a score of their number being cut down around them. Fairweather must have shot nearly 30 of the murderous crowd before the patchet spent its last shell. He stood helpless, unseen and unnoticed, as the uncontrolled slaughter slowed and eventually ceased as his drivers and clients were all slain. He could not comprehend the suddenness that turned the marketplace into a charnel house. "Oh, God," he whispered in a tight, choked voice, watching in cold horror as the savages sat upon the bodies in a cannibalistic frenzy, gnawing at the flesh of their victims. He went on watching with a morbid fascination that slowly transformed to anger and outrage at the sickening tragedy being played out before him. Fairweather was caught in the nightmare of it, powerless to do anything but stare at the horror. Already the butchers who weren't tearing at the hapless tourists were smashing the Land Rovers, hurling rocks through the windows, shattering the glass, venting their insatiable savagery on anything that was foreign to them. Fairweather stepped back into the shadows, sick at the thought that he was responsible for the deaths of his men and clients. He had failed to provide for their safety and unknowingly led them into a bloody disaster. He cursed his impotency to save them and his cowardice at not dying with them. With great force of willpower, he turned his attention away from the marketplace and began running through the narrow streets, through the ruined outskirts and into the desert. To warn other desert travelers of the massacre that awaited them at Asalar, he had to save himself. The distance to the next village to the south was too far to reach without water. He settled instead for the motor track to the east, hoping to find a passing vehicle or a government patrol before he died under the blazing sun. He took a bearing on the North Star and settled down to a fast walk across the desert, knowing his chances of survival were next to nil. Never once did he turn and look back. He could see it all clearly in his mind, and his ears still rang with the agonized screams of the dead.